Since we had never really observed our religion, we didn't sit Shiva, the seven-day Jewish ritual of mourning, for my father. Instead, we had a simple graveside service. I stayed with my mother and sister for a few days, then returned to New York. I contacted the major papers, and my father's obituary ran in all of them. Variety, the only one that would have mattered to him, gave his life a rave review, which included this wonderful line: "He believed in full lighting." What better epitaph for a showman? I should have had a memorial service in New York, but I didn't. It had been such a long time since my father left New York, but I was afraid that no one would come. I envisioned my mother and sister and me sitting alone in an empty hall. Empty seats had always made my father angry. He would have hated not having a full house. I realize now that that was a mistake. Of course people would have come. Just look at the number of people who came to the dedication of Lew Walter's Way, the street-naming tribute arranged by Mayor Bloomberg. My father was finally honored and remembered. I should have done it sooner. As for Castro, I saw him again 2 years later when he came to New York in October 1979 to address the United Nations. He invited me to dinner at the Cuban Mission on Lexington Avenue, and I asked if I could bring other members of the media to meet him on an informal basis. He said to bring anyone I wanted. This started the rumor that because I was acting as Castro's hostess, we must be having an affair. I don't want to disappoint anyone, but let me say once again, Castro and I were most definitely not lovers. No romance, not even a pass, nada. It was quite a dinner, though. Rune, of course, came from ABC News, as well as friends like Catherine Graham, Ben Bradley and Sally Quinn, and Henry Grunwald, the brilliant editor of Time magazine. I asked the top editors of the other major magazines and newspapers in New York, all of whom came, with the exception of A.M. Rosenthal, the managing editor of the New York Times. He alone refused, saying he wouldn't be in the same room as Fidel Castro. I didn't invite any correspondents from CBS or NBC because I thought I might get a new interview with Castro out of the evening, and I didn't want any competition. Not a nice gesture on my part, but then again, television is a tough game, and you don't win by always being Ms. Nice Guy. Well, I didn't get any interview, but after Castro agreed to talk on the record, all my print friends suddenly produced notebooks and for an hour grilled the communist leader. He was as charming and funny as I remembered him, and just as good a short order cook. After the interview, he went into the mission's kitchen and cooked us all a delicious lobster dinner. He followed up the next day by having a live lobster delivered to each guest. Lobster diplomacy. It was to be 25 years before I saw Fidel Castro again. I had repeatedly asked for a new interview, but never received a response. All I got from him was a Christmas card every year, hand-delivered by an official from the Cuban mission. The card usually came by April, and I always hoped it would include an invitation to return to Havana. In October 2002, it finally did. Castro was 76 by then. He had outlasted 9 U.S. presidents, all of whom wished he would vanish off the face of the earth, and was in the midst of his 10th, Bill Clinton. When we met back in the Palace of the Revolution, Castro told me I looked very well. "You look well, too," I said, "only you have gotten grayer and I have gotten blonder." His ever-faithful translator, Juanita, was back at his side, and I was happy to see her. Still lovely, but now gray-haired herself. We hugged each other, remembering our wild trip through the Sierra Maestra so many years before. Back in 1977, Castro told me that he would shave off his beard if the United States lifted the trade embargo against Cuba. In 2002, he still had the beard, and, save for some shipments of food, the United States still enforced the trade embargo. The U.S. government also forbade American tourists from visiting Cuba, though some did, illegally. Other countries had softened toward communist Cuba, and more than 1 million European and Canadian tourists a year were availing themselves of Cuba's sunshine, beaches, and rum. Tourism is now Cuba's biggest business. Was that why he was now wearing a business suit, I asked, instead of his trademark military uniform? Barbara, precisely in order to seduce you and for you to be kind to me, to have pity on me, he joked. You have more questions than the U.S. Air Force has missiles. So his sense of humor remained intact, as did his absolute power. Before our arrival, we had requested an interview with Juan Miguel Gonzalez, the father of Elian Gonzalez. Elian, you will remember, was the 5-year-old refugee from Cuba whose mother had drowned at sea while fleeing to America in 1999, thrusting Elian into the center of a highly publicized, impassioned custody fight between his vehemently anti-Castro relatives in Florida and his father in Cuba, championed by Castro. Elian, whose Miami relatives appealed his extradition to Cuba all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, had been returned to his father, Juan Miguel, in 2000. The drama had riveted the United States for months, but our request to interview the father in Cuba had been turned down. Until my interview with Castro. The next morning, Juan Miguel was sped to Havana in a government car. Elian was very happy to be back in Cuba, his father told me, producing a picture of the boy, then just shy of 9. He's almost as tall as I am. He's doing karate at school. He's a green belt. That good news about Elian was hardly surprising. He had become a poster child for Cuba and appeared often at Castro's side in film clips of national holidays. Castro himself was said to have 5 sons and many grandchildren, including a set of triplets. But as in my past interview, he wouldn't admit to any relationships. When I asked him why, after all these years, he replied, "It's prohibited to go into my personal life. It's not our way." "What's to hide?" I said. "It's my human right," Castro joked. "I cling to my human right to defend my privacy." I kept asking, and finally he admitted, "Yes, we have descendants and all that." I pressed him about the triplets. "Well, I think there are some triplets around. I've heard they exist." That was it for anything personal about Castro. Castro presented me with a farewell gift when we left Havana, a picture book of old combat photos from the Bay of Pigs, titled Memories of a Victory. The text was in Spanish, of course, as was the attached note, translated here. "For Barbara, in whose terrible hands I fell again after 25 years. I promise that I will never try to escape. It's impossible, and I think with affability about our next meeting, arranged for 2027. It is signed, Fidel Castro, and dated October 7th, 2002. Whatever you think of his politics and ideology, he has cut a huge figure in modern history. When he was taken seriously ill in July 2006, no one knew for days whether he was even alive. I was working on this memoir when I heard the news that he was in the hospital for surgery and immediately emailed the Cuban foreign minister, Felipe Perez Roque, to express my concern and ask him to extend my wishes to Castro for his speedy recovery. Lest you think this was a purely beneficent gesture, I also sent a separate email requesting an interview when and if Castro was strong enough. I received no reply from Fidel Castro, and now I never will. The Historic Interview, Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin. The question I am most often asked is, of all the interviews you have done, which is your favorite? Well, favorite is not a word I would use, but if I had to choose the one that meant the most to me, it would be the late president of Egypt, Anwar al-Sadat. He changed the world. At least, he tried to. In bringing about peace, if not friendship, between Egypt and Israel, he took the first great step toward compromise in what remains one of the most contentious and complicated areas of the world. Sadat had foresight, courage, and charisma. He was, in physique, a slim, small man, but in his heart, he was a giant. If I also had to choose the time in my professional life that meant the most to me and of which I am proudest, it would be those same years in the mid-70s in the Middle East. I played a small part in those difficult, tumultuous, and now historic times, and I cherish the memories. A month after my father's death, I went to Beirut to interview Yasser Arafat, the head of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. I had been trying to get an interview with the elusive head of the PLO for years, and in September 1977, he said yes. There was no ABC News magazine like 2020 back then, and so the interview was scheduled to air on ABC's Sunday morning news program, Issues and Answers. At that time, in the eyes of the West and Israel, Arafat was the number one Palestinian terrorist for his violent campaign to secure an independent Palestinian homeland. At the same time, he was a hero and champion to the Palestinians, many of whom had either fled or been expelled from Israel and now lived in squalid refugee camps in Lebanon. Arafat was a powerful figure in the bitter mosaic of the Middle East. It was a very uneasy time in Lebanon. To simplify what was a very complicated struggle, the country was winding down from 2 years of civil war between Christian and Muslim militias. At the same time, the PLO was also launching rocket attacks into Israel, and Israel was responding in kind. Although the situation was volatile, I was concentrating so hard on what I was doing that I didn't consider the danger. I was also in good hands in Beirut. To work with me, ABC had sent a very talented and nice senior news producer, David Jane, who had spent considerable time covering the war in Vietnam. Also along on his own assignment was Larry Buckman, an ABC radio correspondent. We waited for days in the ravaged city to see Arafat. Once a beautiful and prosperous banking center for the entire Middle East, Beirut had been all but destroyed by the violence. The modern buildings in the city's center stood empty, their windows shattered, as did the abandoned resort hotels along the Mediterranean. The images of Beirut in 2006, following the Israeli airstrikes against Hezbollah, another Palestinian terrorist organization, looked eerily similar. While we waited to see Arafat, the PLO took us on what Moshe Dayan had told me would be a propaganda tour of some of the refugee camps. We filmed the camps, and propaganda or not, there was no denying that the Palestinians lived in squalor. Human waste ran through the streets and alleys, and there was garbage everywhere. Little children cried out, "Revolution until victory!" The PLO's anti-Israeli slogan, as they ran through the litter with wooden rifles, pretending they were shooting Israelis. Because there was no satellite transmission at that time between Lebanon and the United States, ABC chartered a plane, and David Jane flew the refugee camp footage to Amman, Jordan, where he could transmit it to New York. Then he returned to Beirut. Our meeting with Arafat took place suddenly one evening, when without any explanation, we were put in a car and driven by a circuitous route through the city. I know we went down several blocks more than once, occasionally in opposite directions, until we stopped in front of a very ordinary apartment building, with washing hung out to dry from the windows. That was the PLO's tactic then, and later Hezbollah's, to blend in with the civilian population. Arafat was waiting for us in a heavily guarded apartment up three steep flights of stairs. His head was bare when we entered, and I remember being struck by the fact that he was bald. I'd never seen a picture of him without a cap or his keffiyeh. When it was time to talk, he then put on his keffiyeh. The long-awaited interview turned out to be as limp as his handshake. He played the same game he always did, coming close to saying he would recognize the right of Israel to exist, then backing off. Arafat always held out the possibility of peace in public interviews, but we knew he took it back in private interviews with his own people. Still, we were happy just to have the interview, and the next day David Jane set off once again to Amman, taking along Larry Buckman, to satellite the footage to New York. I was going to go with them, but at the last minute decided not to. It didn't seem to make sense for me to go to Jordan for one day, since I needed to be back in New York to appear on the program on Sunday, so David and I agreed we would meet in Paris on Friday for the flight home. He never arrived. I waited for hours in Paris with increasing anxiety until I received the terrible phone call. The charter flight David and Larry were on had exploded on takeoff from Amman. They had both been killed, along with the two Jordanian pilots. Investigations were launched, but no explanations were ever found. David and Larry were dead. Gone with them was most of the tape of my interview with Arafat, but that was nothing compared to the loss of their lives. I felt it was my fault. They were in Amman because of my interview. I would get the glory. They got death. I met with their families when I got back to New York. They never blamed me, but I could not help but blame myself. I spoke about Larry's and David's deaths on the news. Newsmen and women are supposed to be impersonal on the air, I said. It's part of our code. But I couldn't come back tonight without talking of my two colleagues who died Friday morning in Amman, Jordan. Larry was young and witty, and the father of three little girls, I told the viewers. David, too, was young, only 40, and had four children. He was the loveliest man, the best and the brightest. It shouldn't have happened. I know it's the business we're in, but I ache for their widows, their children, and ourselves at ABC News. At the end of our interview in Beirut, Arafat had taken the black and white keffiyeh off his head, written on it in Arabic the words, "Revolution until victory." He presented it to me as a gift. My plan was to put it near the small, ancient oil lamp Moshe Dayan had given me to represent the enmities in the Middle East. But when, after I got home, Ikodel unpacked my suitcase, she did not see the imagery. She saw an ink-stained piece of cloth and put it in the washing machine. That took care of that souvenir. I didn't give a damn. The symbol had been rendered meaningless by the crash. David's and Larry's deaths, to me, were two more senseless losses in the morass of hatred in the Middle East. I had interviewed at least once many of the warring leaders in the region, Egypt's Anwar Sadat, Israel's Golda Meir, Moshe Dayan, Menachem Begin, and then the PLO's Arafat. The more interviews I did, the more hopeless things seemed to me. Until November 1977. I was in Kansas City talking with Dolly Parton for a Barbara Walters special, when during an interview with Walter Cronkite, President Sadat stunned the world by announcing that he was willing to go to Jerusalem on a peace mission. All he needed was a formal invitation from Prime Minister Begin to address the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. The invitation was quickly forthcoming from Begin after CBS News reporters corralled him in a hotel in Tel Aviv and set up an interview with him in a hotel room. Cronkite skillfully knitted the two interviews together, making it appear as if the President of Egypt and the Prime Minister of Israel were talking to each other, a historical first in itself, and the network's race to Jerusalem was on. Actually, earlier that same day, it was Peter Jennings, ABC's chief foreign correspondent, whom Sadat had first told off-camera about his willingness to go to Jerusalem for peace. It would have been Peter's historic story if he'd had a camera crew with him, but he didn't, so he lost the breaking news to CBS and Cronkite. Peter took another blow when Roon designated me ABC's lead reporter on Sadat's journey to Jerusalem. Peter's objection was valid. He had covered the Middle East for a long time. Roon did it, he later said, because of my strong relationship with both Sadat and Begin. Peter held this against me for years. I didn't blame him, but I didn't turn down the assignment. Sadat's sudden announcement that he was going to Jerusalem on November 19th, just 5 days after Begin extended his invitation, set us all scrambling. I flew to Tel Aviv on November 18th, on the same flight as NBC's anchor, John Chancellor, both of us wondering where Cronkite was. I learned the answer late that night, after interviewing Moshe Dayan on the prospect of peace with his former and formidable enemy. Exhausted after the long flight and the interview, I was sound asleep in my hotel room when the phone rang. Cronkite's in Cairo, Roon announced from New York. He's got a seat on Sadat's plane tomorrow to Tel Aviv. Chancellor may be on that plane, too. Get on that plane. Right. I couldn't call the Egyptians I knew in Cairo because there was no direct line between Egypt and Israel, the country that didn't exist for them. So I got out my phone book and called Egypt's ambassador to the United States, Ashraf Gorbal, at his home in Washington. God knows what time it was, but I had to get a seat on Sadat's plane. I pleaded with the ambassador, and he said he would try but could give me no guarantees. 2 hours later, he came through. "You will be welcome on President Sadat's plane," he said. But how to get to Cairo? There were no direct flights between Egypt and Israel, remember? I could take an Israeli plane to Cyprus and then transfer to a Cypriot flight to Egypt, but that wouldn't get me there in time to make Sadat's plane. Fortunately, we heard about a French jet that CBS had chartered to fly in their satellite equipment from Paris to Tel Aviv. We paid the French pilots to fly me to Egypt. We would stop very briefly in Cyprus and take off again. I grabbed our film crew and off we flew. Once in the air, I leaned my head against the window and fell asleep, having not had that luxury in close to 24 hours. I woke with a start to see the pyramids directly below us. I thought I was dreaming, but it turned out the Egyptians had not made us stop in Cyprus. Amazingly, the pilots got permission to fly non-stop from Tel Aviv to Cairo, a matter of just over an hour. We were the first civilian plane to make this direct trip to Egypt since the creation of Israel in 1948. Historic, but at the time, we had more important things to think about. We landed in an airport that was almost empty. Security was very tight in light of Arab resistance to Sadat's solo journey for peace. I bolted out of our plane and ran toward the main terminal, and there, with incredulous looks on their faces, were John Chancellor and Walter Cronkite. As Cronkite later recalled on the PBS program American Masters, "I was boarding the plane in Cairo when a little private plane landed on the field, and she hopped out of it and ran across the field like a football player going into the play, holding her hand up, 'Wait, wait, wait for me.'" The two news anchors were not overjoyed to see me. "I couldn't have been unhappier," Walter confessed. "As for me, I couldn't have been more thrilled that I'd made the flight, and in short order, we were in the air again, this time to pick up Sadat at his weekend retreat in Ismailia." Going up against Chancellor and Cronkite was a scary prospect, but there we were, ABC, NBC, and CBS in one plane. The only other American journalist on board was Wilton Wynn from Time. We landed near the town of Ismailia, and there was Sadat, beaming and meticulously dressed in a navy blue suit. He walked slowly along a red carpet past an Egyptian honor guard and his major ministers. His foreign minister and former friend Ismail Fahmy was not among them. Calling Sadat a traitor, he had resigned in protest of this visit to Israel. Sadat did not seem perturbed. As he got close to us, I reached out with my microphone and asked, "Mr. President, what are your feelings at this moment?" I did not get the exclusive, newsworthy soundbite I'd wanted to flash home. "Barbara," Sadat exclaimed in his booming voice. "So you made the plane?" I laughed, but before I could repeat my question, Sadat turned to Cronkite and asked just as loudly, "Walter, what do you think of Barbara making the plane?"
"Well, Mr. President," Walter said dryly, "it's not exactly what I had in mind."
When we were airborne again, Sadat invited the three of us into his private cabin for a brief interview. We drew straws en route to see who would get the first question. That seemed very important at the time, but now I can't remember who won, so I suspect it wasn't me. But I had an ace up my sleeve. Before we entered the cabin, I'd written a question on a slip of paper. "Mr. President, would you agree to do an interview with me after you speak at the Knesset?" To make the request easy to answer, I'd put four boxes at the bottom of the page reading, "Yes, No, Alone, with PM Begin." As we left the cabin, I slipped the note to one of his aides. ABC was broadcasting live President Sadat's history-making arrival on Israeli soil, and as soon as the plane landed, I ran across the tarmac to find Peter Jennings and the ABC setup at the airport. I didn't even have time to look at the note Sadat's aide had returned to me as we landed.
I was probably still panting when I went on the air with Peter to describe the plane flight from Egypt and the interview we'd had with Sadat. Only then did I look at the note I'd stuffed in my bag. Yes, Sadat had checked, and alone. It would have been even better if he'd agreed to be interviewed with Begin, but no matter, I'd gotten an exclusive with the man of the hour. I lost the piece of paper, of course. I lose everything. The only person I told was my producer, Justin Friedland, who then had to set up the secret interview without my competitors knowing about it. If the word got out, I was afraid that Sadat would have to include them. With the interview sewed up, I relaxed for a tiny moment to take in the extraordinary scene at the airport. There were hundreds of people waving Israeli and Egyptian flags. I wondered how the Israelis had managed to get so many Egyptian flags so quickly, and how the Israeli army band had gotten the music and learned the Egyptian national anthem. But most of all, I remember all of Sadat's former enemies lined up to greet him. Menachem Begin, Golda Meir, Moshe Dayan, Ariel Sharon, Yitzhak Rabin. It was almost too much to comprehend. It was certainly too much for the viewers back home, who had tuned into ABC to watch the Ohio State versus Michigan football game. Instead of seeing the kickoff on their screens, the football fans saw Sadat's dramatic arrival in Israel. They were furious and jammed the ABC telephone lines to complain. After 7 minutes, ABC went back to the football game to the fans' great relief. To hell with history. Justin and I drove from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. What a sight. All along the road were people cheering. Small children waving Israeli and Egyptian flags. The impossible had happened. The enemy had come to Israel. We all felt optimistic. If Sadat was meeting with Begin, could peace be far behind? It was one of the most glorious days I had ever experienced. Arriving in Jerusalem, I went directly to an interview I'd arranged with Prime Minister Begin. The Prime Minister's residence was small and modest. Begin and his wife, Eliza, whom by now I knew quite well, greeted me, and the Prime Minister took me into his study. It was a very personal room with photos of his family all around. I had expected Begin to talk of Sadat and the triumph of this day. Instead, with great emotion, he talked of the Holocaust and the pictures of his relatives who had died in the concentration camps. Those were the thoughts uppermost in his mind after meeting Anwar Sadat. After the interview, Begin seemed energized. He had a busy schedule the next day, including following Sadat in addressing the Knesset, but he was obviously too excited to go to bed. He still hadn't prepared his remarks to the Israeli parliament. He never wrote anything in advance, he told me. Instead, he asked his faithful aide, Yahil Kadishai, for a Bible to look up some references for the address. He was still talking long after midnight when Kadishai said, "Mr. Prime Minister, for all our sakes, please go to bed." Begin left, but like a child who just wouldn't go to bed, he popped out again. "Barbara," he said, "I forgot to tell you something. On the ride from the airport, I said to President Sadat, 'For the sake of our good friend Barbara, would you do the interview tomorrow with me together?' And Barbara," Sadat said, "yes. So we do it in the Knesset when we're finished speaking." Richard Nixon may have gotten me an interview with Prince Philip, but Begin had gotten me the most important interview of my career. "Thank you, Prime Minister," I said. "Thank you so much." And off he went to bed. The next day, Justin had a small room off the main chamber of the Knesset all set up for the joint interview. There was no football game that day, so ABC broadcast live Sadat's extraordinary address to the Israeli Knesset and Begin's speech as well. Shortly afterward, the two leaders arrived at the room to meet me amidst a great commotion of Israeli security guards and Egyptian soldiers, followed by a few incredulous members of the Israeli press. I had stayed up most of the night preparing questions for this first-ever joint interview with the leaders of Israel and Egypt. I talked with them for 40 minutes, two tape cassettes worth in TV time, during which the difficulties on the road to a finalized peace quickly emerged. Both men expressed their admiration and even liking for each other, but the devil of an actual peace agreement was in the details.
Sadat had said in his address to the Knesset that although everything was negotiable, the Arab people would not concede one inch of occupied land, and he reiterated his position when I asked him whether he would give up any of that land for peace. "Not at all," he said, "not at all." "Well, I'm afraid I don't understand," I said. "If you will not give up any of the land, if none of it is negotiable, then what will you be trying?" "We can sit together, we can talk, no one knows what will happen in the next week or so." I pressed on until Sadat said, "Barbara, politics can't be conducted like this." "I have to keep trying," I said to him. I then tried a lighter question and asked President Sadat if he planned to invite Prime Minister Begin to Cairo. "I am planning to invite him to Sinai," Sadat replied with a mischievous smile. Sinai was, of course, still occupied by the Israelis. "Well," Begin shot back, "I invite you," and they both laughed. We covered other topics as well, including the sensitive subject of a possible Palestinian state. Begin said very firmly, "My position is no." We also talked about Sadat's visit earlier in the day to the Holocaust Memorial at Yad Vashem. "I was very moved," he said. "I never thought it reached to such an extent like I saw today." I also asked Sadat, remembering other Egyptians who considered him a traitor, if he was at all concerned for his physical safety. "Why should I be? I will not be taken 1 minute before God wants it," he replied. 4 years later, as a result of this quest for peace, he would be assassinated. What some American people didn't understand then, and may still not, was the significance of Egypt's place in the Middle East, and why Sadat's unilateral quest for peace with Israel had drawn such condemnation from the other Arab leaders, including King Hussein of Jordan. The answer was in the numbers. Egypt had 2/3 of the Arab population in the Middle East, counting the Sudan, and by far the greatest military capability. What Egypt did greatly affected all the other Arab countries in the region. "Is it true that there cannot be war or peace in the Arab world without Egypt?" I asked Sadat. "This is a fact," he replied. "War or peace is decided in Egypt because we are 40 million people." I was very proud of this interview. It made headlines around the world the next day and started a firestorm at CBS. As soon as my interview with Begin and Sadat ended, Justin grabbed the tape cassettes and rushed to the Israeli Television Broadcast Center to edit the conversation and satellite it to New York. The word quickly spread, prompting an Israeli driver for CBS to run to his producers and say, "ABC has Sadat and Begin." And the chase was on. CBS staffers frantically tracked down the two leaders and pleaded with them to do another interview, this time with Walter Cronkite. CBS News was so determined to beat the upstart third-place ABC News, not to mention the possibility that I might personally upstage the much more authoritative Cronkite, that they instantly transmitted Cronkite's entire unedited interview back to New York and directly onto 60 Minutes. That turned out to be a mistake. Not only did ABC get my interview on the air seconds before CBS ran Cronkite's, but at the end of his interview, Cronkite is clearly heard saying, "Did Barbara get anything I didn't get?" I returned to New York, having slept the entire way home in a nest the El Al steward made for me on the floor, to find my status greatly improved in the news division. The back-to-back interviews with Castro and Arafat, followed by the interview with Sadat and Begin, had put me back on the map as a serious journalist. It didn't hurt that I'd gone head-to-head with Chancellor and Cronkite, the top men in broadcast journalism at the time, and, you should excuse the expression, beaten the pants off them. From that time on, I was more or less accepted as a member of the old boys' club. But I had unfinished business. I had a major plan in mind. At the end of my interview with Begin and Sadat, I had asked them if their respective ambassadors in Washington could at least now meet and talk, which they've never done before. Sadat thought for a minute and then replied, "Why not? I say today we are ready." Begin then also agreed.
I hope that starting from tomorrow the ambassadors of Egypt and Israel all over the world will give common interviews and meet with journalists and express their opinions. I immediately phoned Simcha Dinitz, the Israeli ambassador to the United States, and his Egyptian counterpart, Ambassador Gorbal, to invite them to do a joint interview with me on issues and answers when I returned home. Dinitz agreed, but Gorbal refused. He didn't want their first exchange to take place publicly on television. So instead, I invited them to an off-the-record dinner party, which they both accepted. This was, believe me, a major event. Even today, the Egyptian and Israeli ambassadors are rarely at the same dinner. I hosted the dinner, a coming-out party of sorts, at the Madison Hotel in Washington, just a few weeks after I'd returned from Israel. Though both diplomats were assigned to the United States and both lived in Washington, they had never met. They couldn't, for Egypt and Israel were still technically at war and had been actively at times since 1948. What a euphoric time it was for all of us. I carefully planned the party. Among the guests were Catherine Graham, Ben Bradley, and Sally Quinn, the humorist Art Buchwald, President Carter's close advisor Hamilton Jordan, Carter's press secretary Jody Powell, Carter's national security advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, the outgoing Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and my old friend Bill Sapphire, by then a columnist at the New York Times. I also asked Sam Donaldson, our incomparable White House correspondent, Peter Jennings, and about 30 others. All eyes were on the two ambassadors, who stood and chatted for the first time during pre-dinner cocktails. They later recalled that their first exchanges were meaningless pleasantries. "We even discussed the weather," Ambassador Dinitz said. "But then we talked more substance, and it was a good feeling." Luckily, Bill Sapphire took notes that evening, because I never would have remembered exactly what their toasts were to each other during the dinner. Ambassador Dinitz praised Ambassador Gorbal for his ability and professionalism, and sometimes I wasn't too happy about that, and then went on to recall the smiling faces of the children he had watched on television welcoming President Sadat to Israel. "It is incumbent on us to give them a reason for their smile," he said. Ambassador Gorbal responded in kind. "For the first time, Ambassador Dinitz has spoken for both Israel and Egypt," he said, and went on to pledge his government's commitment to a full, comprehensive settlement, "and not leave it to the next generation." He then raised his glass to the prospect of peace, to the ambassador of Israel, and to President Carter. The party was a great success. As Henry Kissinger said in his brief and amusing remarks, "I have not addressed such a distinguished audience since dining alone in the Hall of Mirrors," referring to the hall in the Palace of Versailles outside Paris, where the treaty was signed ending World War I. Everything at the party was supposed to be off the record, but the next day, to my horror, I read an item in the gossip column in the Washington Star about the incomprehensible behavior of Hamilton Jordan at the party. The president, soon to be chief of staff, had evidently had too much to drink and insulted his dinner partner, Amal Gorbal, the Egyptian ambassador's wife, by staring down the front of her décolletage and announcing, "I've always wanted to see the pyramids." I nearly fainted when I read it. Sam Donaldson was at the table and was asked if it happened. He wouldn't admit it publicly, but he told me privately it had. I had been so busy being a hostess that, perhaps luckily, I didn't see or hear any of this. But the sorry story made the rounds of the newspapers, including the Washington Post and the New York Times, leading Bill Sapphire to feel free to write about the more gracious part of the evening in his New York Times column. He titled it Barbara's Dinner Party, and it was a very nice piece that mercifully left out the Hamilton Jordan story. Even more mercifully, Ambassador Gorbal did not seem upset. For all the hopes for peace at the time and the feelings of goodwill between the Israelis and the Egyptians in 1977, the peace talks didn't progress until Jimmy Carter essentially locked up Begin, Sadat, and their respective delegations from Israel and Egypt at Camp David in September 1978. I was assigned to cover this. A news blackout was imposed on the press, leaving us hanging around the outside of the presidential retreat, we weren't allowed inside, waiting for any news droppings and chasing down rumors. One of the most persistent was that Jordan's King Hussein was about to fly to Washington from London to join the talks. I can't tell you how many times I was told, "Jordan's coming in." The rumor was so persistent that several people began reporting it as the truth. I had King Hussein's private phone number in London where he was staying, and when I alone got him on the phone, he denied, categorically, that he was heading to the United States. Hussein, in fact, was dead set against Sadat making a separate peace with Israel. Further, he told me that no one from the White House had even been in touch with him. So I went on the air and reported that, quoting King Hussein, and the next day someone else would again report that he was coming to Camp David. It made me very uneasy. I'd spoken to the only person who knew whether or not he was coming to Washington, the king himself, and I believed him. Yet something inside me wondered whether the print reporters knew something I didn't. I was struck once again by the power of the printed word. It reminded me of my own mother believing the lies the papers printed about me when I started at ABC. But Hussein, as he had told me, did not come to Camp David. My reporting was correct. Sadat himself almost left, frustrated with his supposed partners for peace. Jimmy Carter had to keep intervening between the two delegations until finally, after 13 days, and setting aside the thorny issue of Jerusalem, they reached an agreement. On September 17, 1978, Sadat and Begin, shepherded by Jimmy Carter, signed the Camp David Peace Accords at the White House. This, again, was a huge story, and I hope to have another joint interview with the two leaders. Begin said yes, but Sadat said no. His representatives would not say why. Therefore, the next day, I interviewed each in his respective embassy. I remember the interviews clearly, mostly because many of the questions I asked them were deliberately identical. One was about the status of Jerusalem, to which Begin replied that 99% of Jews worldwide considered Jerusalem the capital of Israel, while Sadat said that 700 million Muslims and Arabs would disagree. Another question was about Israeli settlements in what the Palestinians considered their land in Gaza and the West Bank. Begin said he considered the settlements essential to the security of Israel, while Sadat insisted that Israel had no claim of sovereignty over either. It is stunning to review those questions today and realize that, although Israel has given up its settlements in Gaza, there is still no resolution on the West Bank or Jerusalem. At the time of Camp David, however, it truly seemed as if Israel and Egypt were going to work out their differences and achieve a lasting peace in the Middle East acceptable to the Palestinians and the other Arab countries. 30 years later, peace remains elusive. In the historic spirit of the moment, I did something I'd never done before and haven't since. At the end of my respective interviews, I asked both Begin and Sadat to autograph my copy of the questions I'd put to them. "To Barbara, with admiration," Begin wrote. "Best wishes," Sadat wrote, followed by something in Arabic, then the word, "peace." I had the questions framed, and they hang still on that long wall in my apartment. Yes, it is a very long wall. They are dated September 18, 1978. I finally remembered to keep something. For all the celebration, the Camp David Peace Accords were not a final peace treaty. They were merely the framework for one. Egypt and Israel were supposed to work out the remaining issues within these guidelines by the end of 1978. Of course, they didn't. I'm going to fast forward now to March 1979, when I made another seminal trip to the Middle East. Because the Egyptians and the Israelis had failed to resolve the differences between them, Jimmy Carter decided to intervene again by commuting between Sadat in Egypt and Begin in Israel to try to bring the peace process to closure. A large press corps, including me, went with him. We started in Cairo,
where Carter was negotiating privately with Sadat. Once again, we were in a news blackout. Nothing is more frustrating to a reporter, and there was a huge contingent of us, 194 journalists and technicians, angling for the smallest scrap of information. ABC alone sent 13 correspondents, 14 producers, 24 technicians, 2 editors, 2 unit managers, and almost 7,000 pounds of equipment to cover the peace agreement, if it ever happened. I interviewed Jahan Sadat. She wouldn't comment on the talks. I interviewed Jody Powell, who said, "Nothing is happening." It was a disappointing stalemate. I worked the phones, which is an often insurmountable challenge in Egypt. I was scheduled to make several on-air live reports a day on the most important news story in the world, and all I could report was that I had nothing to report. But nobody else did either, although I worried constantly about Cronkite and Chancellor. After 3 no-news days in Cairo and a side trip to Alexandria, we all flew to Jerusalem where Carter was to meet with Begin in the King David Hotel. We were jammed behind security guards at the hotel entrance when I saw the arrival of another Israeli friend, Defense Minister Azer Weitzman. "Mr. Minister," I yelled at him, "nobody will say anything. Please give me 2 minutes." Azer walked toward me, and I thought I was finally going to get something to report, but no. "2 minutes I will gladly give you, but like this, without words," he said, giving me a big hug. Thanks, but no thanks. To lift our collective spirits, several of us decided to give Sam Donaldson, my very good pal, a surprise 45th birthday party. Sam loves to tell the story of how I lured him to the party by inviting him to my room, alone. Whether or not he really means it, Sam insists that he thought I was inviting him to a tryst and went into a schoolboy tizzy of picking just the right red tie. He always wears a red tie. 50 people gathered in my room, including Cronkite, Dan Rather, Chancellor, and Jody Powell. When Sam knocked on the door, we all screamed, "Surprise!" No tryst, but Sam had a very good time anyway, especially when the belly dancer arrived. Sam's surprise party was the highlight of the no-news peace offensive that week. Many of the White House press corps returned to Washington calling Carter's peace mission a complete failure. Cronkite stayed behind, as did Chancellor. So did I, because I had lined up an interview with Prime Minister Begin. I was going to ask him why the mission had fallen apart, whose fault it was, and so on. I then planned to go to Cairo to ask the same questions of Sadat. This is where it finally became interesting. My interview with Begin was scheduled for 4 p.m. at his home in Jerusalem. We were there and ready to go, but there was a complication. Carter had unexpectedly returned to Cairo the day before to talk further with Sadat, and 24 hours later, they were still talking. Nothing seemed to be conclusive, but we didn't want to do our post-mortem with Begin until Carter officially gave up and was on his way home. We managed to finagle an extra hour from Begin, during which Aliza Begin served us all orange drinks and chocolates, then more orange drinks and more chocolates, until Begin finally said, "Enough." We sat down to start the interview, in which we thought he was going to blame Sadat for the peace effort's collapse, when the phone rang. Begin took the call in the kitchen. It was Carter, calling from the Cairo airport. The smile on Begin's face was a yard wide when he came back into the living room. "I can tell you that the president gave me good news," he said, "but that's all I can tell you." We knew we were at the center of a big story, but we didn't know what it was. We were frantic. Bob Fry, my producer, took his walkie-talkie and contacted the ABC Bureau in Jerusalem. He was told that Carter had read a statement to the press at the airport that was being transmitted to New York. "Get it from New York and read it to us," Fry told the Bureau. So there we all were, including Prime Minister Begin, huddled around the walkie-talkie, listening to Carter's statement. "Sadat has agreed to..." And the walkie-talkie went dead. We grabbed Begin's phone and called New York. My assistant on this trip, Shirley Craig, took down the wording of Carter's announcement in shorthand, then knelt beside Begin to read it to him. He listened silently as Shirley read, occasionally nodding his head in agreement.
It was an unbelievable moment. We immediately started the interview with Begin. He didn't yet know the details of the agreement, so we focused on his feelings. Begin was as animated as I'd ever seen him, and although he tried to be calm and statesmanlike, it was obvious he was thrilled. It wasn't a very long interview, he had to get to his office, but it was a portrait of peace in the making. Hooray, we had a scoop. As soon as I finished, I flew to Cairo, through Cyprus this time, to get the other side of the portrait of peace. There, my luck ran out. It was almost 11 p.m. when we finally got to Sadat's residence in Giza overlooking the Nile. I tried to persuade a security guard to take him a message that we wanted to have a few words with him, but the guard refused. So we were reduced, no kidding, to throwing pebbles at Sadat's windows trying to get his attention. Why we weren't arrested, I can't imagine. But finally, another guard consented to take a note from me to Sadat. The answer came back that he would not see us then, but would be pleased to see me when he came to Washington to sign the final peace treaty. That in itself was news. So at 2 a.m, I did a stand-up report outside Sadat's house, announcing that the Egyptian president would be going to Washington for the official signing of the peace treaty. I was so tired that we had to do at least 6 takes. We were all delirious by then and grateful for a 1-bedroom suite, the only hotel room available. 4 of us piled into that one room and slept on the twin beds, Shirley, Bob Fry, and a reporter from TV Guide, John Weissman, who was doing a story on how television was covering the Sadat visit. He couldn't get a room, so we said, join us. I remember thinking that I hadn't washed my hair in a week, so while they slept, I showered and washed my hair with Egyptian soap. The funny things that stay in your mind. Finally, on March 16, 1979, we returned to New York. It is said that journalists have to be objective and fair, and I like to think we are. But there is no doubt that the television networks were part of the peace process. During this whole Carter, Begin, and Sadat shuttle, television was able to run with the story much faster than the newspapers and way ahead of the news magazines. The print journalists were not happy. The new and not very complimentary phrase they used was video diplomacy, starting with Cronkite's doctored split-screen interviews with Sadat and Begin, and continuing through my interview with the 2 leaders at the Knesset and later on with Begin in Jerusalem. But like it or not, television had become the dominant purveyor of news by the late 70s and was central to the story in the Middle East. As John Weissman later wrote in TV Guide, from the very beginning, from Anwar al-Sadat's historic trip to Jerusalem in November 1977, the story was a TV story. Indeed, if Vietnam had been the world's first TV war, the Israeli-Egyptian agreement was the world's first television peace. Golda Meir's observation was more cryptic. I'm not sure, in the end, whether Begin and Sadat will get the Nobel, she said, but for certain both should get the Oscar. They did indeed get the Nobel Peace Prize. And on March 26, 1979, Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin finally signed the formal Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty in an elaborate ceremony on the South Lawn of the White House. I went as a guest of Senator John Warner. Finally, I wasn't working and could savor the moment, but not for long. I had yet another interview lined up with President Sadat at the Egyptian embassy at 4:30. This was a little nerve-wracking in that we had to get the interview taped and edited in time to make the 7 o'clock broadcast. We made it by seconds, but there was little joy at the Egyptian embassy. Sadat's courageous act was already being condemned throughout the Arab world. The Arab League would shortly suspend Egypt's membership, and the leaders of Egypt's former Arab allies would sever diplomatic ties with the country. The atmosphere was very different in the Israeli camp when I interviewed Begin later that night. I remember the festive celebration in Begin's hotel suite where he and his staff were singing Hebrew folk songs. What a golden time it was, full of hope and heroes and the promise of peace. I would stay in touch with both Sadat and Begin,
I spoke individually to them with some frequency, sent them cards on all the appropriate occasions, and did several more interviews with each of them. But events moved on, sometimes tragically. In October 1981, Anwar Sadat was shot at a military parade in Cairo by Muslim extremists who had infiltrated the army. The assailants considered Sadat a traitor. I was stunned and grief-stricken when I heard the news. ABC asked me to help to find out about Sadat. Had he survived? Was he dead? I called the hospital in Cairo and managed to talk to one of his aides. I knew the answer when he told me that Jahan Sadat had left the hospital. She would never have left her husband's side if he were still alive. 8 hours later, the Egyptians officially confirmed his death. Peter Jennings and I covered Sadat's funeral in Cairo. Though dignitaries from the Arab countries were conspicuously absent, many other leaders came, including Menachem Begin and three former U.S. presidents, Jimmy Carter, Gerald Ford, and Richard Nixon. Instead of the streets of Cairo being lined with mourners, they were empty and eerily quiet. Peter and I couldn't decide whether people had stayed home because they were afraid or because they had turned against Sadat. Whatever the reason, it made for the strangest, saddest funeral procession. Afterward, I went to President Sadat's house as a friend, not a reporter, to offer my condolences to Jahan Sadat. We embraced and then sat together and shared our memories of her husband. "You know, you were the only one I was ever jealous of because Anwar liked you so much," she told me with a smile. What a lovely compliment from a lovely woman who remains my friend to this day. Mrs. Sadat talked movingly about her husband in an interview with me 3 months later. She had asked him to wear a bulletproof vest to the parade, but he refused. "When God is ready to take me, he'll take me," he had said to her. "Okay," she'd replied, "but you don't have to help." He'd also had a premonition of his death. Their son Gamal was leaving on a trip to the United States a few days before the military parade, and after his father said goodbye to him, he called him back. "Gamal," he said, "you must take care of your mother." Jahan told me this with tears in her eyes. "My husband knew," she said. "He knew." I felt depressed and discouraged when I flew home from the funeral. Another loss, another senseless death. I had no idea that I'd be back in the Middle East just a week later to attend yet another funeral, this one of my old friend Moshe Dayan. Moshe had been sick for a long time with colon cancer and was even losing sight in his one remaining eye. The cause of his death was given as a massive heart attack. Personally, I think the cause of his death was his life. He had been denounced in Israel for his failure as Minister of Defense to anticipate the 1973 Yom Kippur War. Many Israelis had never forgiven him until his funeral. Thousands of people now turned out to pay their final respects and file past his coffin. To Dayan's widow, Raquel, they were hypocrites. "Where were they all when he needed them?" she said bitterly to me. I was very close to Raquel and even lent her a black dress to wear to the funeral. She didn't have a proper one in her closet. When the streams of people paying condolences left her house after the burial, I and a friend from America, Lola Finkelstein, helped tidy up and wash the dishes. My heart ached for Raquel and was heavy for myself as well. Moshe and I used to make the rounds of antiquity dealers in New York when he came to give lectures. He spent whatever extra money he had on ancient artifacts and had a remarkable collection at his home in Israel. Moshe Dayan was a man far ahead of his time. He was convinced that the only way to solve the Palestinian problem peacefully was to grant them autonomy, a controversial position then. He was one of Israel's chief negotiators with the Egyptians at Camp David in 1977. He was also the author of several history books, including one on the Bible. Dayan was loved and hated, but he never cared what others thought of him. Like Sadat, he had an enormous personality, great humor, and charm when it suited him. He was an extraordinary general and totally original.
I knew no one quite like him, and I am grateful that I got to know him as a friend. Of the three people I admired most in the Middle East, only Menachem Begin was then still alive, but our cordial relationship eroded in 1982 during an interview in which I questioned him pointedly about the wisdom of Israel's invasion and subsequent occupation of southern Lebanon. Although Begin was being roundly criticized in both the Arab and Western press, and his popularity had dropped sharply in Israel, he obviously hadn't expected such criticism from me. After the interview, he looked straight at me and said, "And you too, Barbara." He was very angry and never really forgave me for asking. To Begin, I was now just one more adversarial reporter. After Sadat and Diane died, the chapter of my life in the Middle East more or less came to a close. I would interview Yasser Arafat again, this time in Cuba, at a conference of non-aligned nations, and I would interview other Arab leaders, Jordan's King Hussein, Libya's Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, more recently Hussein's heir, King Abdullah of Jordan, and another Abdullah, the King of Saudi Arabia. But nothing would ever come close to recapturing the excitement of covering the peace process between Egypt and Israel in the mid-70s and of meeting and knowing the great men of that time. That is not to say there was no more excitement in my life, it just moved to a different hemisphere. Exit Harry, enter Hugh. The other question I am most often asked is whether being a woman in what was, and still is to a degree, such a predominantly male profession has been a hindrance or a help. The answer, of course, is both. On the negative side, there were the Frank McGees and the Harry Reasoners, who were threatened by the thought of a woman as their professional equal. On the positive side, there have been plenty of men and women who had no concerns whether it was a man or a woman interviewing them. That is usually the case, I have found, even in countries like Saudi Arabia, where women are so severely discriminated against. In 2005, King Abdullah chose me from among all the American journalists who had requested to do the first interview with him after he inherited the throne. The king evidently had no trouble being questioned by a woman, and furthermore, by a woman whose head was only partially covered. It may be that Arab leaders welcome the modern image of them it projects, or it might be as simple as their recognizing that Western female reporters have different customs and therefore not expecting them to adhere to the same strictures as their own female citizens. There are other times when being a woman can be an advantage. Sex rears its happy little head, and a sought-after male subject chooses you to do the interview in the hope that somewhere along the line, the romantic side, or at least the flirtatious side, will surpass the professional. Though, as I've said, Fidel Castro never made the slightest pass at me, I felt he liked me. Did he give me more of his time than he might have given a male journalist? Possibly. But there was no possibly about the intentions of the Panamanian dictator, General Omar Torrijos, whom I interviewed in 1978. He saw me, liked me, and decided to give me special access. Listen, folks, it sometimes works the other way. Nancy Reagan, for example, had a crush on and friendship with Mike Wallace and saved several of her post-White House interviews for him. Considering that Torrijos' attraction to me worked to my advantage, it was fine with me. I was in Panama in April 1978 because the U.S. Senate was about to vote on whether to ratify a treaty negotiated by Jimmy Carter and Torrijos that would transfer the sovereignty and eventual control of the Panama Canal to the Panamanians. This was a very controversial issue at the time, and had the potential for danger. I had wanted to bring my assistant, Mary Hornicle, with me, but my producer, again Justin Friedland, said no, it wasn't safe. If the Senate vote went against the return of the canal, Americans were not going to be very popular in Panama. And if we had to get out of the country in a hurry, he didn't want to have to worry about anyone but the smallest possible crew. So Justin and I went alone with one cameraman, a sound technician, and an ABC photographer. General Torrijos, whose formal titles included
maximum leader of the Panamanian Revolution and supreme chief of government, was a charismatic man with chiseled features that spoke of his Indian ancestry. He was said to have the walk of the hunter, meaning that he could come upon you silently from behind without your knowing it. The future of the Panama Canal was the top story of the time. Everyone wanted to hear from Torrijos. Rune Arledge had dispatched me to try to get him to do an exclusive interview. It was an important assignment. But I was conflicted about being away from New York at what was a pivotal time for me and for ABC News. Rune was about to alter the face of the news radically. It was obvious that Harry and I were not going to make it as dual anchors. Something had to be done to relieve us of our mutual discomfort, which was getting closer to agony. So Rune's very creative solution was to abandon the idea of two anchors or even one sitting behind a desk. Instead, he said, the position of a sole anchor was dead. It was not, but his proposal then seemed to placate the naysayers. He was going to have not one, not two, but three anchors to bring the news from their separate locations. He would have, as the primary anchor in Washington, the very experienced and professional Frank Reynolds, and in Chicago, he would have Max Robinson, the first African-American network news anchor. The new boy in town, Peter Jennings, would be based in London. The name of the broadcast would be changed to World News Tonight. As for Harry Reasoner, he was going back to CBS. After much deliberation, Rune had decided that I had a greater future at ABC than Harry did, so he released him from his contract. Rune was betting that I would earn my salary, and although some in the company felt he was making a mistake, Rune had his own vision, and that vision included me. He gave me a new title, not just roving anchor, but chief correspondent for special events, with the authority and, he hoped, the ability to travel the world and land the big newsmaker interviews. Rune was trying to work out the timing of this important announcement about the changes in ABC News, and I was very nervous about exactly how this would affect me. In the meantime, Rune sent me off to Panama. When I arrived, I immediately sought out Torrijos's advisors and pressed my case that, as with Fidel Castro, Sadat, and Begin, I would be best able to bring the most attention to their general and his cause. They agreed and promised a brief interview before the Senate vote. That was the best they could do. At the moment, Torrijos was on the resort island of Contadora, where he went to relax and where, by the way, the deposed Shah of Iran was brought a year later for temporary refuge after he was forced into exile. I was told to be ready at 7 a.m. to fly to the island in Torrijos's private helicopter. I landed slightly flustered from lack of sleep and with bloodshot eyes, but Torrijos didn't seem to care, and although he didn't speak a word of English and I speak no Spanish, we obviously got through to each other in more ways than one. In the interview, the general warned Congress that he would not take lightly a defeat of the proposal to return the canal to Panama. But the big question was, what would he do if the vote did not go his way? Torrijos would not tell me. The U.S. Senate vote on the canal was scheduled for the next day, April 18th, and because Torrijos was so, shall we say, taken with me, I asked him then and there for a second interview right after the vote. He agreed. We were certainly off to a good start. There were hundreds of journalists in Panama all vying for Torrijos's exclusive attention, and we'd gotten it. Justin and I felt quite smug as we choppered back to the mainland. Our smugness didn't last. We waited all the next day for our promised interview with the general. Nothing. The Senate debate was dragging on and on, postponing the vote and our exclusive interview. The word finally came from one of the general's aides that he'd changed his mind and there would be no interview. Swell. That left me with nothing for the evening news, so we did the next best thing. We did a stand-up in front of the house where it was thought Torrijos was listening on the radio to the debate. That's where the adventure began. A uniformed man suddenly appeared. The general wants you to join him in the house, he directed. I looked at Justin. Go, he said.
I'll feed this piece back to New York and catch up with you. Immediately, I was escorted past an incredulous and unhappy group of correspondents from NBC and CBS into the house to spend the rest of the day and most of the evening in the company of General Torrijos. There were no other women in the house, only I and Torrijos's inner circle of military aides and friends. They were all listening to the debate in Washington. The general's interpreter was translating for him, and it occurred to me that if the vote went against Panama, Torrijos might not be very pleased with his now favored American correspondent. What might he do with me? Hold me hostage? Not a happy thought, but not a crazy one. I was by now fervently hoping that the vote would favor the occupants of the room, especially the general, who made sure that I was by his side. We were inseparable through the rest of the debate, and then on the ride to the Panamanian Television Broadcast Center, where he was going to monitor the actual vote. I searched for Justin in the crowd outside the broadcast center, and to my relief, saw him waving at me. I also saw the amazed faces of reporters from around the world who were patiently waiting for a simple statement from Torrijos, while I was being firmly escorted inside the building by the general himself. We went into a conference room where, again, I was the only woman. The vote was being broadcast in Spanish by Panama Radio. Torrijos and his men hung on every number. Most of the time they cheered, so I knew the vote was going as they had hoped. Their cheers broke into wild applause when the result was announced. The canal would be returned to Panama. An overjoyed Torrijos then revealed the real reason he had been keeping me so close to him. He told me, through his interpreter, that if the vote had ended up going against Panama, he had instructed the Panamanian army to destroy the locks on the canal. He had planned to take me up with him in his helicopter to witness the canal's destruction. That would have been quite a coup for me, but one I am glad I didn't get. Who knows how my own country would have reacted? But the agreement was passed, and I felt that I was now free to find Justin and do my big report. The general, however, wasn't through with me. Taking my hand, he led me outside through cheering, jostling crowds to the National Guard headquarters, where he gave a press conference. Then we went on to several other celebrations. I don't know how Justin did it, but every time I emerged from some building with Torrijos, Justin was there. At one point, the crowds were so huge that I found Justin waving at me halfway up a tree. It was all very exciting, but embarrassing. Here were all the networks and the world press chronicling this historic moment, and there was I, smack in their lenses, but there was nothing I could do about it. I begged the general to do an interview with me then and there. He didn't want to, but promised to do one with me the next day. What I had to do then, and as soon as possible, was to get the story of this day on the air, especially his threat to destroy the canal. I finally did, late that night. The other correspondents in Panama were quick to discredit this story, claiming that it was impossible to blow up the canal and that I'd made it up. That really stung, especially because they inaccurately reported my words. What he had said and what I reported was not that he would have blown up the canal, but that he planned to blow up the locks controlling the entrance to the canal, thereby flooding it and rendering the canal useless. I'd barely gone to bed that night when it was 5:30 a.m., time to get up to report live for Good Morning America. Once again, I was sleep-deprived when we left on a small military plane to fly back to Contadora, Torrijos's Camp David by the sea. I was so anxious about the press conference Rune was holding that very day in New York at 21 to announce the change in format for the nightly news that en route, Justin and I considered patching a phone feed through Torrijos's house to the restaurant so I could participate in some way, but we gave up the idea as impractical and disruptive. So, instead of being greeted by my colleagues at 21, I was greeted by Torrijos in a jumpsuit, lounging in a hammock under his shaded portico. His staff had prepared a breakfast that even 21 couldn't equal. Fresh orange juice, mounds of mangoes, pineapples, and grapefruit, eggs however we wanted them,
ham, bacon, muffins, coffee. All this against the backdrop of the waves breaking on the beach, a bright blue sky, warm sun, and a balmy tropical breeze. I just wanted to stretch out and sleep for 3 days. But I was there to work, and we did the interview, during which I asked him to confirm the threat I'd reported. "General," I asked, "when you said you would destroy the canal if the treaty were not ratified, were you serious?"
"Yes, I spoke seriously," he replied. "It was a decision very painful, but there was no other alternative to take."
I asked him how he intended to do that.
"It is very simple," he said. "The canal is as indefensible as a newborn baby. We know every critical point of the canal."
"And you were going to take me with you last night if you had done this, so I could watch?"
"I thought of taking you along so that they would have proof that we did it," he said.
I was vindicated, and very eager to get back to New York. The New York Times had tracked me down in Panama to ask me about Rune's pending reorganization. I didn't want to jump the gun on Rune's press conference, but I did make clear that what I didn't want to do was to be anchored to a news desk, and what I did want to do was what I was doing at the moment, covering stories and doing reporters' notebook pieces. "I was very unhappy last year co-anchoring with Harry," I told the Times. "This year I'm very happy." My idea of happiness, however, did not jibe with that of General Torrijos.
"Stay here for a few days," he said through his jolly interpreter.
"I can't possibly," I said. "I don't even have a bathing suit."
"We will get you one," he countered.
"I have a flight to New York," I said.
"Stay," he insisted. "Later I'll have my plane fly you back."
It's hard to argue with someone who has his own country, including the bathing suit concession and a fleet of planes. I thanked him for the invitation and the offer of a private plane to return me to New York, but explained that for business reasons, I simply had to get back to New York right away. I was so insistent that he relented and actually made it possible. I would never have made the Braniff flight I was booked on without his help. Not only did Torrijos send me off in his private plane, he called the airport and had the commercial flight to New York delayed. The general's plane landed, taxied right up to the Braniff plane, I rushed from one to the other, and we took off. That was the last contact I ever had with the romantic dictator, who died in a mysterious plane crash 3 years later.